John Stott is very fond of telling the story about an extremely wealthy woman who was known to be in possession of a fortune, that when she died, people were naturally interested in how much the fortune was and where it had gone. And at the funeral, some rather courageous person asked the minister, how much did she leave? To which he had the wisdom to answer, everything. you can't take it with you. From which John always goes on to make the point that life is like a pilgrimage between two moments of nakedness, and therefore we'd be well advised to travel light in the meantime. Both of those stories, in a sense, could well be used as illustrations of this passage, precisely the one that we have just read, and indeed the very idea that we have come naked into the world and we leave the world naked comes exactly from this passage. Reminding us, indeed, of what a perceptive and modern book this Ecclesiastes is. I don't know whether you've studied it before or if you've just come this morning for the first time to realize that, in fact, we've been looking at this book over a series in these lunchtime meetings. And it is a book, one of the most provoking books in the Bible, because it really does observe life as it really is, life at the sharp end, life in a world which is fallen and a mess, and most of the time pretty absurd, and we try to make sense of it. And the author here is wrestling with those realities. And this particular section about greed and wealth is one of a short series, in chapters 4 and 5 especially, where he's been observing people and the kind of pitfall that they fall into. He's looked, for example, at the workers who fall into workaholism in chapter 4. He's looked at heroes who are very transient in their heroism. He looks at worshippers in beginning of chapter 5, who are often very superficial. And then he's just looked at the officials of bureaucracy and how they pile one on top of the other and so on. So he's looking here and there around him in the world and observing how often life is lived with futility and stupidity, which he calls meaninglessness. And here, in this section, he's looking at greed, and as the title to the talk was called, The Greedy Life. And he says four very negative things about the love of money, and then manages to say one very positive thing about wealth in itself at the end. You may have noticed a bit of a sudden shock and an upturn in between the nakedness and darkness and wretchedness of verse 15 to 17, and then suddenly he says, yeah, but it's good and proper to eat and drink and enjoy life if that's what God gives you. So we look at the four negative things briefly and then finish off with that one very positive piece of advice, which we can link in, I think, to some things that are said in the New Testament as well. First of all, then, in verses 8 and 9, he says that greed is oppressive when it gets bogged down in bureaucracy. Verses 8 and 9. If you see the poor oppressed in a district and justice and rights denied, well, you may well be upset about that. You ought certainly to get angry about that. Most of us, when we see such things on our television screens or in the news, even in our own country, and we see the suffering of the poor and oppressed throughout the world, we would get angry. We'd feel it shouldn't happen like that. But this writer says what you shouldn't be is you shouldn't be surprised, because that's the way it is. We live in a world in which greedy people pile themselves on top of other greedy people in a kind of great, stinking pile of parasites, in which the whole effect is that the people at the bottom of the heap simply get squashed virtually out of existence because of the greedy people on top of them. So don't be surprised at that, because he says it's like a capillary effect. You've heard about the trickle-down theory of wealth, and we all know that it's really a mockery of the way things actually happen, that in the whole it's a capillary effect of greed, that it sucks everything up from the bottom through the layers of bureaucracy to the very top indeed, as verse 9 says. So greed is oppressive. That's the way it happens. So much bureaucracy in the world is caused because people are greedy and they simply pile the bureaucracy around them to protect themselves. Secondly, greed is unsatisfying and produces anxiety in verses 10 and 12. Again, very perceptive comment. I heard a few murmurs of agreement around the church when verse 10 was read out. Whoever loves money never has enough money. And whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. just seems to be true, isn't it? Did you ever hear anybody who, no matter how wealthy they were, said that they really had enough to make ends meet? Sometimes it is we are amused on the television when we hear these interviews with extremely wealthy people who start complaining about all the problems they have and the difficulties of making ends meet. Desire is insatiable, the very nature of it. Greed feeds on itself. Like other human desires, once they get out of control, whether that's the greed for power or for wealth or for sex or for whatever else it might be, even for exercise. Read in Metro this morning, wasn't it, about some woman who'd become an exercise freak and couldn't get enough of it and was virtually dying of anorexia because she was always on the treadmill. Somehow, when our desires get out of control, they become destructive. One commentator talks about the self-destroying and self-defeating nature of greed. And that's what this writer is observing. And he goes on to say that, of course, the more money you have, the more friends you'll suddenly discover who want to spend it for you. Verse 11, as goods increase, so do those who consume them. Again, the stories of the lottery winners bears that out. You get a lot of money and you find you've suddenly got a lot of friends you never knew you had before who want to help you spend it. But do you get much personal benefit from it? Well, perhaps not. What benefit are they to the owner except to feast his eyes on them? What can you do with massive wealth and massive riches? There's only a certain amount of food you can eat, or drink you can drink, or pleasures you can indulge in, or things you can buy to look at, or ornaments, whatever else. What benefit ultimately is it to you? All it may bring you at the end is anxiety and sleeplessness, as verse 12 says, that the poor person goes to bed and sleeps because he's been working hard all day, but the abundance of a rich man, and perhaps the surfeit of food and his indigestion, permits him no sleep. But not only the kind of anxiety from the sleeplessness from indigestion, but the anxiety of wealth. I suppose I oughtn't to be amused, but it sometimes puzzles me when you go to sometimes hyper-wealthy neighborhoods in some places of the world, and you see these high walls and the electric fences and the guards and the guard dogs and the expensive alarm systems and the armed response signs and all of this, and you think, these people are wealthy, but they're virtually living in prison. Imprisoned in their wealth. Very comfortable prison, of course. But still, who wants all that anxiety, all that expense, just to protect the wealth you've got? Perhaps that's why another very wise man, the person who wrote some parts of the book of Proverbs, says, and this is just a few pages earlier in Proverbs chapter 30, verses 7 to 9, here's a wise approach. This man says, two things I ask of you, O Lord, do not refuse me before I die. Keep falsehood and lies far from me, and give me neither poverty nor riches, but give me only my daily bread. Otherwise I may have too much and disown you and say, who is the Lord? Or I may become poor and steal and so dishonor the name of my God. And so the theme of those verses really is enough, that's what I want, sufficient to live on. Because excessive wealth will lead me into arrogance, in which I think I don't need God. Who needs God if you've got ingots? In God we trust, as they say. And also he said, but on the other hand, I don't want to be poor. It's not a prayer for poverty. That's not the ideal, because that may lead to greed and envy and stealing and other evils as well. So sufficiency is what he wants, because otherwise greed is unsatisfying and produces anxiety. Thirdly, he says, greed is unreliable in times of misfortune. This is verses 13 and 14. He says, I've seen something awful happen under the sun, and that is wealth hoarded to the harm of its owner. Now, he doesn't specify what he means exactly by that. Perhaps he's thinking he's seen somebody who grew very wealthy, and then their affluent lifestyle became an unhealthy lifestyle, and they got obese or whatever it was, and they ended up being harmed by their very wealth that they were enjoying. Or it may be spiritual or moral harm that wealth and greed has led somebody into, simply because they were greedy. So it's been hoarded to their own harm, or it's all been lost through some misfortune. And again, we sometimes read those stories, or we see them, don't we, where people accumulate enormous wealth and suddenly it just vanishes through some misfortune. The market collapses, a bank goes bust, pension funds get plundered, an unwise investment goes belly up, or whatever it is. And the result is that you've virtually nothing left from all that you started out having. And even some appalling stories of people who win millions on the lottery, and within a year or two they've got virtually nothing left because it's all squandered and gone. And he says, in such a case, the man who thought he had so much ends up with nothing to hand on to his son, verse 14b. When he has a son, there is nothing left for him. So that's one side of the story. The other side of that particular theme is in chapter 2, verse 18 to 21, where this same writer observes that he says about himself, he's speaking in the first person, that he's worked hard all his life to earn all this money and achieve all this position, but who's he going to hand it on to? It's not that he's got nothing to hand on, but he doesn't really trust the person he's going to hand it on to. So this is chapter 2, verse 18. He says, I hated all the things that I toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether he'll be a wise man or a complete idiot. He might be a fool, yet he will have control over all the work into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. And this too is meaningless, he says. I do all the work, he gets all the profit, and what's the sense in that? And so my heart began to despair over all the toilsome labor under the sun. For a man may do his work with wisdom and knowledge and skill, and there's nothing wrong with that. The Bible approves of all those things. But then he must leave all that he owns to someone who has not worked for it. And this too is meaningless and a great misfortune. So he's been very honest in his observations about the handing on of wealth or not, as the case may be. Someone was telling me the other day, we were discussing great foundations and wealth in the United States for charitable purposes, and this person said that some survey that had been done of the mega wealthy in the States, both Christian and non-Christian, came up with what was their number one worry. What did they lose most sleep over? And apparently the number one worry among the very wealthy in the States is over the heir. That is, who's going to get it? Whether that was a worry about the moral quality or capacity of the heir, the son, the second generation, or the sons in the family, particularly the fact that they've grown up with all this wealth and abundance and haven't had to struggle for it as the man may have done who earned it all, for, you know, the sort of rags to riches, I've made it in life, but what about the next generation? Or the possibility that the next generation, once they got their hands on it, would waste it and squander it. And apparently this is a huge anxiety to many of the very, very wealthy in America. It's a worry I'm not going to have, or my son. I've got two very fine sons, and I'm not worrying about what they're going to do with my wealth, I have to say, because it won't be very much. So greed is unreliable. It can leave you. It says goodbye, as they say, and in the end you've got nothing to hand on. And finally, the fourth very negative thing that he says about wealth, and perhaps the worst of all, is in verse 15 to 17, where he says it is really pathetic in the face of death. And I struggled for some other word than pathetic, but that seemed to be the right one, because these are very gloomy verses. And the author says, look, naked a man comes from his mother's womb, and as he comes, so he departs. He takes nothing from his labor that he can carry in his hand. This is a grievous evil. As a man comes, so he departs. What does he gain from all the toil that he does in his lifetime, all his days that he eats, and so on? So in the light of the nakedness of our birth and the nakedness of our death, and as it were, the great beyond, eternity beyond that, all this lifetime of accumulation and striving after accumulation really seems pretty pointless in the light of what is to come. This author is, of course, perpetually bothered by death. He doesn't have the perspective that we have as Christians in the New Testament of the reality of the resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ, which Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15 rescues us from vanity and futility, because he says your work is not in vain in the Lord when you're in Christ. But faced with the otherwise reality of death, what is the point of all this accumulation? You're going to die naked and you can't take it with you. And he feels very strongly about this, so strongly that he describes it in this very sharp language: darkness, frustration, affliction, and anger. Here is somebody who feels deeply about this. He's not some sort of world-weary cynic. He's not just mocking. He's not just sort of laughing at the wealthy. He says, this really is a problem to me. What is the point of all this work and all this accumulation if at the end you leave it and die? Perhaps it was that theme from Ecclesiastes which partly inspired Jesus when he was faced with possibly a greedy person. We're not told exactly, although Jesus seems to have thought he was, in Luke chapter 12, verse 13. When someone in the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Here again, we've got problems over inherited wealth. But Jesus wouldn't have anything to do with it. He said, "Man, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter between you?" And then he went on, "Watch out," he said, "be on your guard against all kinds of greed, because a man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." Very famous words of Jesus. And still very, very relevant, because our whole culture seems to suggest that it is. That's exactly what a person's life and worth and value and significance consist in, precisely their possession. Jesus said it doesn't. And then he told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop, and he thought to himself, "What shall I do? I've got no place to store my crops. I've got too much wealth to cope with." And then he said, "This is what I'll do." Well, now, he should have known what to do, because the law of the Old Testament talked about sharing with the poor and the needy and giving of your produce to those who have none. So he ought to have known what God wanted him to do with his wealth. But all he could think of was, "Well, I'll tear down my barns and I'll build bigger ones, and there I will store all my grain and all my goods. And I will say to myself, 'Hey, you've got plenty of good things laid up for many years. You don't need to do a day's work ever again. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry. I've won the jackpot.'" And God said to him, "You fool, this very night your life will be demanded of you. And then who will get what you've prepared for yourself?" So in the face of our certain and possibly imminent death, all this greed stuff becomes pretty pathetic. So that's Jesus' parable. So four things then. Greed is oppressive and bureaucratic. It's unsatisfying and anxious. It's unreliable in the face of misfortune, and it's pretty pathetic in the face of death. And yet, remarkably, in the last moment or two of our time, in the last few verses of this chapter, verses 18 to 20, there's a sudden positive note that comes through here that Ecclesiastes returns to. Greed may well be destructive and frustrating, the love of wealth and money, but wealth in itself, that which we've worked for and accumulated, that which God gives, is not in itself an evil thing. When it is received from God and used with productive work and with joy and with satisfaction. So the answer to greed is not some kind of asceticism in which we withdraw into some kind of false poverty. It's not the kind of violent anti-wealth protest that we see and may well have some sympathy with when we see what corporate greed is doing in our world today. But the answer is not a violent response or a totally withdrawing response, but rather a grateful and a responsible enjoyment of what God has given us in the time that we have to enjoy it. And he says, "Then I realize that it is good and proper," says the NIV. The word is actually beautiful. Same word as we have in creation and elsewhere. It's good and beautiful to enjoy food and drink and satisfaction and labor. Okay, your labor may be toilsome through your life, even if your life is short, because that is what God has given to you. And when God gives that, it is to be enjoyed as received from him. Now that is as far as this author gets. He doesn't go much beyond that. He simply accepts that if God is in it, and if wealth is received and used responsibly under God, then it can be a satisfying thing. It is the love of wealth which causes the problem. Paul takes it a little bit further, and this is where we close. Paul himself, in 1 Timothy chapter 6, again probably echoing the words of Ecclesiastes, but in 1 Timothy chapter 6, he addresses precisely this problem. He says in verse 6, "Godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. Because people who want to get rich fall into temptations and traps and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. and some people eager for money have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. So there's Paul's answer to Ecclesiastes. So what should you do then if you have wealth? Paul says in verse 17, command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, not to put their hope in their wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. But again, he's not being ascetic. He's not being negative about it. Richly provides everything for our enjoyment. But command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. And in this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age. So, the use of our wealth is the important issue. Let me finish by saying that in personal experience, because as Paul said, I sometimes travel to parts of the world where it's extremely poor and share with people there, and sometimes also, again, because of the charitable nature of the organization, to places where there is enormous wealth which people want to give away. And I've sometimes found that a very challenging thing, sometimes within a matter of a few days, to share on the one hand the generous poverty of Christians in places like India and elsewhere, who will do exactly what this verse says, to share in their hospitality to the needs of someone who is actually wealthier than they are, but also to share in the generous wealth of Christians and others in places like the United States, where they are concerned to use the wealth that God has entrusted to them, seeing it not as something to glory in for themselves, not as something that they can simply spend on their own selfish ends, but as something they've been entrusted with to use for the kingdom of God and for the benefit of other human beings. In both cases, I suggest, this is, as Ecclesiastes would say, good and beautiful and comes as a gift from God. May God help us to take that kind of a responsible and serious attitude to the possessions that God has given to us, for his name's sake.